Hey, Film Wax Radio welcomes back the Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Film program to the show. The Vermont College of Fine Arts MFA in Film offers a two-year student design, project-driven graduate program of professional mentorships for your scripts, fiction and nonfiction filmmaking, and hybrid and transmedia projects. Each semester begins with an on-campus residency week of screenings, workshop lectures, and crits, along with preparation of an independent study plan for your own personal projects. Then, students and faculty return home to work independently and meet monthly via Skype as projects unfold. The MFA program is designed to fit into the life you have and the films you make. Exciting, affordable, and intense, refine your creative vision as you develop intensely personal stories in an independent practice. Visit vcfa.edu/film for more details. And now, on with the show. Hello, everybody. This is Adam Sharger, host of Film Wax Radio. You're listening to episode number 420 of the podcast. I hope your summer's going well. I hope things are okay. We are in the dog days here of summer, leading up to what they just announced a couple of days ago, the New York Film Festival. Unbelievable. Unbelievable lineup. I can only say very excited about it. The opening night is the latest Richard Linklater film. It's called Last Flag Flying, and I believe it is in the kind of an unofficial sequel to The Last Detail, right? The Hal Ashby's film from way back. And this is supposedly a quasi-sequel to that. I don't really know for sure how official that is, but I guess we'll find out when we get Richard Linklater on this podcast, right? This is going to be the time. This is the movie. Again, that's the opening night film. The closing night film, let's take a baby step backward. The centerpiece is Wonderstruck by Todd Haynes, and Todd has been on this podcast, so maybe this will be an opportunity to get him back on. If not at the New York Film Festival, then maybe sometime leading up to the theatrical. And finally, the closing night film is from someone named Woody Allen. It's called Wonder Wheel. Now, supposedly Kent Jones, he's the senior programmer for the New York Film Festival, walked out of that film. According to him, he was speechless. So I'm going to take his words for it. And we're going to get Kent. I think we're going to get Kent on the show. So we'll just assume that's the case. And we'll talk to Kent directly. He's been on a couple of times before. But I just have to say, not only is former FilmWax Radio guests Claire Denis on with a film called Bright Sunshine in... A little clumsy title, but I'm sure there's a reason behind it. The Florida Project, directed by Sean Baker, who's been on this show before. Greta Gerwig has her film direct. This might be her directorial debut, unless I'm mistaken. It's called Lady Bird. Of course, she's a former guest. Noah Baumbach is back on with the Meyerowitz stories. And Noah's been on the show. Also from having been in Joaquin Trier with Thelma. So we have a lot of alumni coming on the podcast, as well as Luca Guadagnino with Call Me By Your Name. I am not familiar with this particular film. Hong Sang-soo with The Day After. These are people who I just really like and whose films are always on my radar, and I always try to catch when they come out. Dee Reese is finally back with the film after many years, called Mudbound, and I've been looking forward to that, and she's at that. And then New York Film Festival favorite Aki Kaurismäki is going to be back in the festival with a film called The Other Side of Hope. Just looks very, very exciting. It's a really exceptional festival for those in and around New York. It's going to take place here in the city between September 28th and October 15th, so we'll see you at that. Okay, episode number 420 is Single Conversation. These are my favorite shows. Try to pretend otherwise. I always prefer bringing on somebody who I know, who has a long career, and who can talk, and who's generous and giving. And Whitney Dow is certainly no exception from that select group of people. And he's never been on the podcast before, somehow. So we rectified that. And Whitney is a documentary filmmaker who has one of my favorite documentaries that he co-directed from years ago called The Two Towns of Jasper. And that film, which came out in 2003, is actually going to have an encore broadcast on POV. So I want you to mark this down in your calendars. August the 14th, after you listen to this conversation, you're going to want to go back and see that film. So if you check your local PBS affiliate, but it's going to be on the Encore on August the 14th, coming up just next week. So I'm really glad to be able to promote that. The film was directed, again, co-directed, I should say, by Whitney Dow and Marco Williams. And you should just listen to this conversation with Whitney. And this hopefully will, I'll be able to send this to Marco and get Marco on the show as soon as possible. I didn't actually know that there was going to be this broadcast of this film. Otherwise, I definitely would have asked for Marco to join us in this conversation. And I hope maybe I mentioned in this also in this particular conversation that, you know, I would love to host a screening of the film. So we're approaching the 50 in 2018. We'll be approaching the 15th anniversary of this film, but the documentary, but also we'll be approaching the 20th anniversary of the actual tragic incident in which this documentary is about or based on. So it's a good maybe time to do an honorary screening in that regard sometime in the next year or so. If you don't get a chance to see it on PBS and you live nearby, maybe we can put this together for you. Also, we are discussing a new project that Whitney's involved with called The Whiteness Project. And, you know, Whitney has, by the way, got this track record, including The Two Towns of Jasper, being a socially progressive documentary filmmaker. And The Whiteness Project is really no different. It's kind of covering, in a sense, the same. He's in that same sphere, in that same world, only a very different perspective on it. But this is a very, very ambitious, broad project, and you can check out whitenessproject.org for more information, maybe after you listen to this episode, and learn more about what he's doing. Okay, so that's what's going on with Whitney, and that's primarily what we're going to be talking about, as well as his background. And he has a fascinating background, so it was just a delight. So let's get into that. I'm not going to do an outro today, so you know, we're gearing up towards a very, very important period of time shortly. I am going to be doing a fundraiser coming up in September. I'm leaking that now. I'm not saying exactly what the amount will be now, but I can just tell you that I am going to be not only trying to expand on what I'm currently doing here at Film Wax Radio, which is doing this podcast, but I want to have more opportunities and choices about the kinds of segments I do. I want them all to be fantastic. I want to be able to have more options and choices, and I want to do a consistently high-quality show. We're coming into our seventh year. I think I have every reason at this point to do something like this and to reach out to my friends and my fans and my listeners and my guests, and finally maybe ask for a little bit of help in able to achieve this. Not only will I be expanding on just what I can do with the podcast, but I'm going to be going beyond the podcast in terms of how I champion and how I help along independent filmmakers and films themselves. And so more to come about that over the next couple of weeks or a few weeks, and then we're going to go into, by September, into this campaign mode. And I just look for your support, whether it's chipping in or just spreading the word. So look out for that. And consistently, still, the show will be paying every week, of course. Let's get into it right now. My conversation with documentary filmmaker Whitney Dow here on Film Wax Radio, episode number 420.
She is.
So you weren't kidding when you said you were intimidated.
No,
she can be intimidating. I should say.
Yeah, she's very intimidating. And
well, it's the age too.
Yeah, but I have two other daughters who are not intimidating at all. And mm-hmm. So I thought she was going to be like, I could get. I really wanted her. She wants to be in production, but I wanted her to like work with women filmmakers so she could sort of see, get some sort of role models to work with women. And she wants.
There's other good sides to that if she's attractive or anything like that. It's yes. just being around women. Is
yes. Sick. And then she wants to work with narrative, and I do documentary, and I found yeah. her at internship. And I thought she'd be going in, like, cleaning the office a couple of days a week. And they put her on, like, 10 hours a day.
What?
You know, for, like, 5 days a week, doing all this stuff. So she's now she's – so.
Is she going into her – last year of high school, or is she going to first year of college?
Last year of high school.
Okay, that's all right then.
But she's like a New York City high school kid, which yeah, is like,
right,
you know.
Which is like a senior executive at some yeah, sort of corporation, I mean, or something.
The kids that I've met, like New York City,
really sophisticated,
especially New York City public school yeah. kids, are like, some of them are just like
scary.
Yeah. In their, like, understanding of the universe.
Being really poised.
Yeah.
Articulated.
Without being dicks. Without being, like, you meet, like, certain, like, you know, private school kids who are really yeah. poised.
Yeah.
But they're assholes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's more, you have 3 daughters?
Yes.
Wait, is that even legal in this city? I don't, anyway, it's different scenario with boys. I mean, you know.
Yes, do you have two boys?
You have urbane daughters. I have one son. Who has a half sister
mm-hmm.
that is not my daughter?
Ah, that lives with you?
No, lives with his sister and their mom, my ex.
Ah.
So my ex had a daughter after we split.
Okay, so your son lives. You share.
Yeah. And in a case like, for instance, I just happened to have a little bit more flexibility with my schedule, and they didn't have somebody like a. nanny type. I was a nanny for the last month or so leading up to. So I basically did live with them. Like, I was taking care of picking them up at school, the last yeah. days of school, and then also, you know, camp. They were both going to city camp, and now that's no longer the case. Now my kid went up to sleepaway, but he was in a 3D animation camp.
Oh, really?
For 2 weeks, right up to this past week, yeah.
Where?
At the New York Film Academy. They have a uh-huh. campus, like, down on Lower Manhattan, Lower Broadway. Right mm-hmm. by where the bull is, you know. And he learned 3D animation. He's into filmmaking, but so far, like, stop animation, that type of thing. So this was quite different even for him, but he learned a lot.
Well, there's a really interesting, my daughter, who's 15, this other mm-hmm. one. This
middle one?
17, the youngest one. The
so there's a 16-year-old?
There's a 15, a 17, and a 19.
Oh, you have an older daughter. I didn't go that way.
He's in college.
Okay.
And there's a 15-year-old who's really interested in animation, interested in art, and she's this summer she's doing something called pre-college at RISD, where she spends 6 weeks doing art 7 hours a day.
Wow.
And
that's fantastic.
When your son gets a little older,
yeah.
if he's interested in animation, it's a really amazing program. Most kids do it between their junior and senior year. My daughter is doing it between her freshman and her sophomore and junior year. But you have to apply early because a lot of the slots, you know, mm-hmm. but she wanted to do animation. She couldn't, they had like, didn't have any slots in animation. So she's doing drawing because she really likes to do drawing.
So good.
And I was like, look, and they do
also,
like
it's fundamental, a great program.
Fundamentals of design, all this stuff. And it's really treated like a serious art thing. You know, you miss a couple assignments, they kick you out of the program. I mean, it's not like summer camp. It's
yeah.
like, it's hardcore. And it's so... And it's all RISD professors teaching.
Well, I was wondering, my next question was if she was interested in attending that school, that could be maybe a little bit of a
yes.
like nice thing to have on her CV or what have you, you know.
Absolutely.
As far as just, but it sounds like, the, you know, RISD has a lot of pedigree in general, so it could help anywhere, but
yeah.
obviously.
It's a feeder system of some kind.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking of a gentler word, but feeder, yeah.
yeah.
It's a good idea. I mean, you know, it's great that schools are doing that, you know, and I'm sure it's a good means of income for them, too.
Yes.
Yeah. But no, these are kids that sound like they're all kind of yours and mine in a way, interested in arts.
You know. Hopefully they're not interested in documentary filmmaking. my daughter's like, yeah, I want to be in filmmaking. I love mm-hmm. movies.
That's good.
I want to own the studio. I don't want to do what you did. I want to be the one who makes the decisions and like that. She wants to. She's like a Benny Business. She's going to be. I'm hoping that she'll mm-hmm. rise up rapidly yeah. enough that eventually she'll employ me as a director.
Exactly. I was going to say we're going to be working for her.
Yes,
that's fine
absolutely.
With me.
I'm sure she'd fire me without like you know any compunction.
Yeah, she has to make an example.
Yeah, she'd
be like,
you're not cutting it.
Right.
So we're going to have to. Yeah, I think we're thinking to go a different direction. So did you think much about what you wanted to talk about with
you know,
me?
Well, it was one of these things where I feel like one of my favorite things is just to have conversations about you know, working in this world and existing in this world that we live in, with somebody who has a career and been doing it for a while and has a certain number of a certain amount of experience under their belt, and not having necessarily an agenda. And you know, I didn't even look in. Like, do you have a new project that's coming up? I know I overheard you speaking. Maybe some work for hire that you're doing. Sounds like.
Yes.
Okay. Which is it? Which is, you know, I think that is important to talk about. This is something that, you know, a filmmaker with a track record and can get other work, you know, and needs to or wants to or has the option to find other work. It's a good thing. But that's how you make your living as a documentary filmmaker, or part of how you make it.
Yes. I mean, I think that you have to, you know, I think there's a lot of talk about sustainability in our universe now and a lot of talk about how it's not a sustainable, well, it's never been sustainable. Mm-hmm. For very, very few people, it's sort of a sustainable world. So I think you have to sort of build your own ecosystem that works for you. So I do a lot of different things. I mean, I work on films. I work on multi-platform projects. I do work for hire, commercial mm-hmm. work. Mm-hmm. I teach. I give talks at universities.
Yeah.
You're always on the hustle, right? And every year is a little different. Every structure is a little different. Mm-hmm. But I feel in some ways that each one of the pieces of what I do kind of supports the whole of what I think of as, without sounding pretentious, as sort of my practice, that the teaching really helps me think about the work I'm doing. The short form stuff helps me think about the long form and keeps me able to sort of test different ideas and things. The long form stuff gives me sort of the deep dive thought process and in order to like develop more complex ideas. And so I feel kind of like, this idea that somehow, unless you're independently wealthy, this idea that you're going to be able to support yourself just doing long form work that are these artistic 4-year projects is just not realistic.
Right. And I hesitate to say to sort of somehow denigrate, which is a strong word, but to denigrate the work for hire as though it's solely this thing which allows you to make films, because it's more complicated and dimensional, a conversation than just that. That's an easy way of saying, well, I talk to some people who work in the narrative world and make one film for them and one for themselves. You know, that kind of idea is a oversimplification in a way.
No, I agree. I mean, I don't consider the work that for hire that I do as secondary in a lot of ways, because it's the same. I think that, I started my career doing industrials. I did, before I made my first film, I probably made 200 industrial films.
Really?
Yeah, I started.
That's how you got your name.
That's how I got my name. Whitney Dow?
Yeah, it was one of your clients, and it was part of the contract or something.
Exactly. I worked for a place called Fountainhead Productions for years. I started as a salesperson and really wanted to figure out how to become a filmmaker and couldn't afford to go to film school. And I kind of knew if I could get into this place, and I ultimately transitioned to be the creative director and the in-house director and did hundreds of, 1 minute to 5 minute films before I made my first film. And I learned so much in that process. And I think that the process of interviewing people, the process of creating relationships with people you don't know, coming into situations that you don't understand and like quickly sort of trying to boil them down and understand them. All these things that I use today in my film work, it's the same process. Mm-hmm. And, perhaps the output is different, but the actual process of creating a piece of media that's nonfiction media about something is the same.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Okay, yeah.
So yeah, no, the backstory to that being a filmmaker is that I was raised by ethnographic filmmakers. My dad produced ethnographic films.
Okay.
And
Harvard has a whole program for that, right?
Right. And he was actually in the ed school there, and he was a curriculum developer. He worked for a place called Educational Development Center. And he produced a lot of ethnographic films as part of this, and worked with his best friend when I was a kid, was John Marshall, who made all the Bushmen of the Kalahari films. He lived with the Bushmen for decades. And Tim Ash, who made First Contact with Napoleon Chagnon, with Yanomamo, and made all these incredible films. And so all these people were sort of coming through my house, and his tennis partner was Fred Weissman, and I was surrounded by a lot of this stuff growing up. And when I would go to pick him up from his office, because he would never come home, my mother would say, stop by your dad's office and make sure he comes home. And he said, I'll be right there, and just give me a stack of dailies to watch. And it'd be some, the Netsilk Eskimos ice fishing on the summer ice thing, just a bunch of stuff. So I watched a lot of film growing up.
Well, sort of rooted down to, if you were to follow the lineage back to the Flaherty.
Yes.
Stuff, right? That's kind of the, the origins, right, of that.
Yeah, and the thing that was sort of interesting about it is then also meeting the people who did it. They were all good documentary filmmakers. They were, all good storytellers and incredible liars. So they would they would come back from some adventure and come to our house, sit on the dining the kitchen floor, drink whiskey sours.
Spin yarns.
And it seemed very glamorous. So yeah. So anyway, and then
okay,
you know. But, then, of course, I rejected that all and, went to advertising.
So, you did. So, right. And then, so I assume that maybe it was in the 80s into the 90s, the industrials, that period where you were working for.
Yes. Now, it was in the 90s, really, started. And then, at a certain point, you recognize that everything you do is going to the trash can, ultimately. And
So the urge to make something that was more evergreen or permanent was part of your decision to go into making a documentary.
Yeah, and I actually, to confess I'd done I actually wanted to become a more successful advertising director.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at the time when Chris Smith had made American Movie had become a really successful advertising director. And I was, I'd seen what, Bruce Sanofsky and Joe Berlinger had done. And I was kind of like, well, if I'm going to make this transition, I need to make a film. And
had you been to come to New York yet?
No, I was living in New York. In New York.
Okay.
I came to.
When you were doing advertising, it was in New York.
Yes.
Yeah,
I came
sense.
To New York to go to school.
Okay.
The short backstory is prior to going advertising, my first job, I worked for Andy Warhol at the factory as.
So you buried the lead here.
You
worked for Andy Warhol, but for the company, you didn't work for Andy. Wasn't in the.
He was around. Yeah,
he was.
He was. It was the factory on 34th Street.
Oh, really?
On 34th Street.
34th, like a park? Or
it was 34th near Herald Square between 32nd and 33rd Street.
Yeah. I saw him around there a couple of times, that neighborhood. I remember seeing him on the street back then, way back then.
I was sort of I think I was hired to carried boxes. There was a lot of
those are probably Brillo boxes.
Brillo boxes. Or, there were boxes of interview magazines.
Oh, okay. I'm actually going to talk to this filmmaker later who made a short documentary for HBO. About the Brillo boxes.
Oh, really?
Her parents owned one of the Brillo boxes, and then Andy actually signed it with a red crayon. They sold it, and then it went. Years later, it sold for $3 million. That kind of story.
Oh, I have a piece of advertising that he signed because he was really into advertising.
Yeah, right. I remember.
Yeah, he was totally into advertising. And a lot of times I would prepare the lunches for the advertisers he would romance, and he'd come over and he'd be like, "What are you doing?"
All right. So let me just. I stepped on your, here you are telling me you actually interacted. I'm telling you how I saw him on his bullshit, you actually worked for him.
I worked for Interview.
For Interview Magazine. Oh, okay.
When he owned
Interview. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And the two were connected. So you had this building that had the advertising offices and the factory.
Yes. Okay.
And so it was all kind of mashed up together.
How old were you, roughly?
22, 23.
And obviously growing up how you did, you obviously already had a deep appreciation for this opportunity, right? I mean...
I was kind of a knucklehead.
Okay. I'd give you the benefit of the doubt.
I'd done a lot of drugs in high school and college. I was a little bit, you know.
Really?
Yes. And
Cambridge.
And the hotbed of drugs, yes. It was the, you know. The
pot?
Yeah, the Northeastern connection.
Okay.
And, you know, I grew up, my two doors down.
Timothy Leary, I guess, was from.
Well, Timothy Leary was best friends. So I think it was Professor John McClellan. I can't remember his first name. He would live two doors down from us.
Okay.
And so they had these big parties on the lawn, and everybody would be, like, doing drugs.
Really? Okay.
It was, yeah, there was a lot of, you know, I grew up in the era. I think I might be a little older than you. I'm 55. Older are you?
Just barely.
When we grew up, drugs were considered good for you. I mean, it was like, you know, when I grew up, it was like, you know, acid and LSD and cocaine made you much more interesting and, you know,
articulate.
Great conversationalist. Yeah,
exactly.
You know?
Very great.
Yes.
And great in size, anyway.
I even had, you know, it was all right. It wasn't illegal. Like, now you get arrested for sleeping with your teachers. Then it was considered sort of like a badge of honor for the teachers get arrested. You know, I mean, when I was in, I went to boarding school and, like, all the teachers were sleeping with the students. And it was sort of, I felt sort of left out because I didn't get a chance to sleep with any teachers when when I was in high school.
I get it. I'm sorry. For that.
But, you know, we all have our regrets.
Yeah.
So anyway.
So you were working for Interview Magazine, and I just want to get back to this because, so you occasionally he would be in the offices, I guess, right? He was the publisher.
Yeah, right? He would come around and he would say, "What are you doing?" He'd sort of appear behind you.
Like, oh, really?
And you'd hear sort of a voice, "What are you doing?"
Yeah, and that nasally.
"What are you doing?" Kinda, I'd be like, yeah. "I'm writing an invoice." He'd say, "What's an invoice?" I'd say, "Well, you know, you're selling this painting, and I need to, like, write it up to charge the thing." And he'd be like, "Oh, you're so smart. You know so many things. How do you know these things?"
Yeah. Do you think he meant it?
Well, I think it was just his way of engaging her. What are you doing?
Yeah.
I'm preparing manicotti for the advertisers. What's manicotti? Well, it's a noodle with some cheese dessert. You're amazing. You know so much. How do you know about manicotti? That's amazing that you... I mean, it was a performance, but that was sort of his...
shtick.
His shtick. Mm. And, you know, I was working there when he died.
Yeah.
And... that was sort of the, you know, the things sort of changed after he died, and I ultimately left to go into the sailing business.
The sailing. Sailing or selling?
Sailing.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I can give you people a visual picture. I would say if, you know, you do, you know, without being reductive, but you look like somebody from Cambridge who's has some sailing in their background, or maybe some Ivy League or something. I mean, but...
I have all of those.
But it's
yes.
All, yeah. And just maybe just a trace of the drug taking. But I didn't know you had this part of your history about Andy Warhol. That's wonderful. It's great to have had that, right? It's
yeah, I mean, it was, you know, if you were, when did you move to New York?
Well, I grew up here.
You grew up here. So, I mean, I'm very jealous. I mean, I know this is, you know, that like every person under 45 will be like, all these like, you know. Yeah, these old dudes, bastards, complaining. New York in the 70s and 80s was so incredible in a way that is almost impossible to describe. And sort of the possibilities and the frontiers and the forward momentum of art and music.
It's
and
true.
Culture.
Right. You're absolutely true. It's very, very true. Right. No, you're right. When old, it was also like just if you think about the period when there was, people can look on. For what we're talking about, can actually even see a snippet of it, even if you didn't grow up in New York, because you can go, let's say, look at the talk shows of the day, for instance, where you'd see them having on psychedelic rock and roll, you know, artists along with like old Hollywood on the same, you know, it's that period when everybody was alive, and you know, everybody was alive. But I grew up in Queens, and you might have as well have been, and although I'm exaggerating, but you may as well have been, you know, some other country in a sense that there was a lot of that was going on in Manhattan. Yes. And I did make lots of trips and even my high school, we made trips into the city all the time. You know, my parents took me to the public theater. My parents were into the avant-garde. They were into film. So I had a certain amount of exposure, but it's not like I grew up on the streets of the village, you know, although my parents did ultimately when my sister and I moved out, sold their house in Queens and moved right onto Fifth Avenue and 10th Street. So they moved there, but that would have been 1988.
You're like, thanks, Mom and Dad.
Yeah, thanks for waiting until... well, I was really excited for them because my dad, they always wanted to do it. You know, they'd come from New Jersey, and then when they were young adults, before they started their family, they moved, they got married and moved to Queens and then, you know, lived there until we were, I guess, for the next 20 years or something, and then finally moved into the city. Yeah, the city was quite an incredible place where John Lennon and Andy Warhol and just an incredible place to be, you know.
And I think that this idea that like I think you always fall in love with the New York you come up with, right? Like that's
I suppose
a New York.
That's true.
And that I think that in some ways it's easy to say, oh, New York, that was an incredible time. And I, you know, my friend's father who grew up here was like, yeah, you know, New York in the 50s, that was the most amazing time.
Yeah, right.
You know, New York in the 50s was great. But I think that for certain people, for me anyway, the intersection of my personality and what New York was at that time, which was this incredible mixture of like chaos and possibility and danger and coming from an incredibly homogenized world of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Was just incredible to me. Just for whatever it was, I came here when I was 14. My sister was a little older than I was, wanted to come to visit Marco Williams, who's my partner and made a number of films with.
Yeah,
he's a little older than I am. And he grew up on 7th Street and 1st Avenue, between 1st and 2nd. And so my parents, in their wisdom, said, well, if you're going to go visit Marco for New Year's Eve in New York City, you need to take your little brother with you, as somehow I would potentially be the chaperone.
Yeah.
And so this was probably 1976 or 7.
Wow. Okay. So that's really in the heart of that period you're talking about. Yeah.
So
New York, that's right. When Ford literally just told New York.
Dropped dead.
Yeah.
And Marco lived in the parlor apartment. Do you remember those two bars on 7th Street? There was called like 103, and then there was another one right next to it. There was two Ukrainian bars, like right in basement spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived over, I think it was called 103 or 130. I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I go in there, and this is an apartment with one of those police locks that, like, with a big bar that goes
from
the door to
from
the floor.
There was for people that don't remember, there was a hole in the floor designed for a bar that would go on a 45-degree angle or something.
40-degree angle, and
right
lock
against,
into a massive
right
steel panel in the door. Yes.
And that wouldn't keep out, by the way, the riffraff. They just come in through the window or the ceiling, the sunroof or whatever. It didn't matter.
It would slow them down. But for me, it looked like,
I know,
you know,
people
I
had
never
those.
So you would open that,
yes,
and it would slide up, and then it bars in the windows, the front.
My parents had friends with, you know, Manhattan with apartment, and they all had the right, like triple deadlocks and everything. It's so funny.
And then they would have, then the thieves would unscrew the eye bolt and just take a pair of wire clippers and cut the door in half.
That I didn't.
That happened in my building one day, and then they came back into the second apartment the next day. They would just unscrew, and they'd like cut the door in half and just open it.
Yeah.
Like spare swinging doors. And so Marco's solution, he and his friends there, to do with this 14-year-old who, you know, was going to slow them down, was just like, load me up with every drug they could and get me incredibly stoned and lock me in this apartment.
Oh, and then you would be just a deterrent.
I would just be, they could go out
they left you in the bathtub.
They left me there just blasted out of my mind.
Oh,
like I've never been
really
so
did
high.
Go through this period.
And I just remember sitting there, and below, like, you know, police cars are going up and down the street screaming. There's people fighting in the street, scratching. Below me, there's like Ukrainian music blasting, dancing, singing,
they
crying,
had to block out some of that.
Bottle smashing,
right?
All the stuff. And I just remember sitting there thinking, oh my God, I love this place. I'm going to come back here. I knew at that moment I would live here the rest of my life.
76. So you were 26 years old. No, wait.
26. No, 16. I was 14.
14, 16. I was thinking you were born in 16.
I was born in 61.
62?
So I guess it was probably, I was 14. Right. I was like,
I'm going to fix that in post.
Yeah.
Marco Williams, who, again, you made some films together, most maybe notably The Two Towns of Jasper, your feature. Mm-hmm. But how did you know him? Did you know him through the filmmaking?
I knew him because he went to a high school called Buxton.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister went to a high school called Bucks. It was a boarding school in Western Mass.
Oh, okay.
And then I went there. And then he went to Harvard.
And
when I got kicked out of Buxton, I went back home and into Cambridge, and Marco was taking care of him. He lived at our house. So I got to know him. He's 3 or 4 years older than I am, or so.
Yeah.
He's older than I am. And so I got to know him living in Cambridge. And so he's sort of been a family friend
So you got it, by the way, before we forget, give me his email too, although I might have it somewhere. I got to bring him on too eventually. I don't know. Been very delinquent.
If you're going to bring him on, I have to be very careful about what I say, because he might, you know, he'll call me. He calls me on all my lines.
Well, I'm going to do Rushman type thing where I'll bring him on, and then I'll bring you both on.
There we go.
I'll do the trilogy.
And then you'll have to bring the bandit.
Explain.
Isn't the Rashomon the band?
Oh, the band. I see. I'm sorry. I'm lost. Yeah. I just know the expression. I never saw the movie. Not true. But I'm sorry. I keep interrupting you. So that's how you know Marco. And so, and then there's the trips up, and you were staying in his apartment. How you two ever came to make films together is now the next logical question. Wait, no, I think I have it, because you did say before that you had this desire to make something more lasting and less disposable.
Yes.
Right, coming out of all the years of making industrials. So you decided, so maybe that's where Marco came in. But by then, was he already an established?
Yeah, Marco had made a film called In Search of Our Fathers, which was about his search for his father, that had done really well. And we had stayed in touch, and my sort of cynical nature when I was trying to figure out a film to make, I said, I looked around at the films that were doing well. I said, you need a crime. It was like, I need like a movie star, right? You need somebody. I was thinking, if I make a good documentary, and this tells how not strategic and dumb I am, that could help propel me in my advertising career. And I had looked at Chris Smith and how well he had done at this time. I think there's a company that hired him, and like Doug Liman and all these other filmmakers.
Yeah.
And I was sitting at home one day, and I saw this press conference. And in the press conference, there was this cowboy, this sheriff with like a 10-gallon hat and like a two-tone Carhartt jacket with a badge and like high white jeans and boots. And he was giving this press conference, and I was like, he was talking about a man who had been dragged to death behind a truck in his town. And I was like, that's guy is a movie star. I'm going to make a film about him. Mm-hmm. That's all I sort of, and got on a plane and flew down to Jasper and with a friend and started filming. And then, the way I started working with Marco was really coming back from spending the time in Jasper and being so struck by the different narratives that were being told by the black and white
community. Speaking of Rashomon, kind of a twist on that idea where, it is two complete different experiences of living in the same spot. It was a brilliant way in.
Well, just to come in, we've kind of realized that the only way to tell it was to really do it with. I originally went to him for advice because he was a more experienced filmmaker, and we ultimately started talking about working together and making a film where we had these segregated crews, one black and white, one white, each telling these separate stories and then weaving them together. Which would be running, having a rerun on POV, I think, on August 17th.
This is great.
Yeah.
We're going to play this before that. And we're going to, a good reason.
It's a good time.
It's good timing.
Yes.
I'm going to time this then. Oh, so yeah. Well, that's how I learned about that, was through my time and my relationships at POV and having worked there for a short time. I'm not sure now that I think about it, because I think I met you or came in contact with you through your subsequent film about music from Haiti.
Yes.
And contributing to that, that's when I discovered Kickstarter, was with your campaign. And
I'm terribly sorry.
Why? You made your... I remember I wanted to be the last... I wanted to be the... But it's impossible, because everybody wants to be the last one to get you over the...
The hump.
The hump, yeah. But I remember I was there that night and congratulating you online.
That's right. No, that was I got to say that Kickstarter was one of the worst experiences of my life. Have you ever done a Kickstarter?
No, I'm on the cusp. I'm doing one in September.
We should talk.
Okay.
Because yeah. it's like swimming across a raging river with a
like being an
angry
dunker.
Child on your back.
Okay.
Like sticking his fingers in your mouth yeah. and nose and trying to push your head underwater.
I just saw Dunkirk yesterday. I took myself out to the movies for a yeah. change, mm-hmm. and I went to see Dunkirk, and it's like just trying to get across the channel in that movie. That was the whole idea. Is just these soldiers, you know, the British trying to get from France back over to England alive. It was just almost impossible.
That sounds like a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, it has to be a really structured effort.
Well, I'm working with somebody through August on preparing it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have a whole, you know, that a lot of that worked out, and then starting in September. So we'll have a month just to work on preparing for the Kickstarter.
And I think that the...
But I still think it's going to be a harrowing nightmare.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, and I know it is.
All my email accounts got shut off because I was emailing so many, too many emails. If you do like over like 500 emails a day, they'll like...
Oh, wow.
And because I had this realization that I need to hit 500,000 people to get 1,000 people. I mean, I can't remember what it was. So there's,
yeah. It's a pretty, but you are then a pioneer in the sense, I don't mean to yeah. conflate, but the truth is how new was Kickstarter?
It was just
a year or two. So,
yeah.
I mean,
and
no, but there wasn't
a whole lot of things. I mean, I did get
historical data.
I got support from Sundance on it. I got support from Tribeca. I mean, some people pushed on it,
nobody else was doing them.
The reality is that you have to figure out if you're relying on your personal relationships, it's not going to work. I think you have to figure out what is my audience and how do I access that audience and how do I build a narrative within that audience of supporting it. And the ones that are really successful have a built-in audience. And I basically was trying to do something about Haitians. So my natural audience were Haitians who like old Haitian music, who are like Haitians who are like never going to like put their credit card online. Never.
No, most people in most countries don't put their credit card online. A lot of people are hesitant, most of the world, to put a credit card online. Although for a one-time thing, maybe a little less so, but to like kind of subscribe to things, and it's still a bit difficult to get people to do that. But here in this country, it's typical.
It's typical, and I think that you know, one of the most successful Kickstarters I ever saw was like a guy did films on like, you know, technology, and he was doing a film on like magnetic tape storage or something. He raised like $200,000 in like a week. You know, a really dedicated, tech-savvy audience who really gives a shit about the thing that you're doing.
Right.
And, you know, gaming, I think, you know,
gaming
communities
my
do
friend,
well.
My friend did a film about a guy who has a gaming company, and he's been able to raise an enormous amount of money, like enormous, in almost no time. Every time he has to redo his whole... It's like kind of a fantasy gaming thing, anyway. But you're right.
It's funny. So are you doing?
But I have a built-in audience.
Is it for Filmax Radio?
Yeah, the Two Towns of Jasper, right? As you mentioned, are they putting it on broadcast? Or are they putting it on their website for free?
No, broadcast.
Broadcast
is an encore broadcast.
It's great. How many years? What year did that come out? Do you remember?
2003.
14 years ago.
Yeah. That's not a very round number, but
no.
I thought yeah, I,
the 14th, I was, I, if, the big 14th.
If they had waited another year, it could have been 20 years since the murder. But they, you know,
another year.
Yeah, because it was 1998 was the murder.
That would have been a good. But maybe what we can do is, if there's no other bigger offers on the table, and I'm sure there will be some, but I will be happy. We should do something.
Absolutely.
By the way, off the record, there's a lot off the record. I apologize. Yeah. I actually was called into Kickstarter after all this talk. They contacted me to come in. So I'm going in on Thursday to meet with them, and all they said is we have we want to talk to you about collaborating or something about with our screening room. They had this. Have you been over there?
No.
To Greenpoint? Because yours, they weren't even there.
They
were in the village.
Yeah.
You know, about 5 years ago, they moved out to Greenpoint, and they opened a beautiful sort of building over there, and they have this really great screening room. But it would be great if I could do screenings there, and then you know maybe we can.
That would be fun. Do you also do stuff with Tom? At IFC?
Oh, you mean, are you talking about Tom Powers?
Yeah.
No, not much. I mean, I worked for DocNYC 1 year. I did. I produced all the panels, but that had, you know, and then they replaced me with somebody who was also good at raising, you know, and sort of made it a different kind of role. or they just didn't want to bring me back, one or the other. Mm-hmm. But it was, but that's it.
Yeah, no, not, you know, we'd love to do a screening at Kickstarter. I mean, that would be interesting, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I want to see what they are. It would be under the rubric of, like, you know, the film, some sort of thing, a series I would create. Yeah. And then at Kickstarter's, but, you know, I think it would be very interesting to bring back maybe the best of Kickstarter film. I don't know. Maybe it could be something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bundrum Big Beginning is a Kickstarter film.
So what's that?
My Haiti film was a Kickstarter film.
Right. You know,
The film that broke me.
So you chose, well, let's talk about When the Drum Beats, right?
Yeah, When the Drum is Beating.
When the Drum is Beating. Which, and by the way, I just remember also what a striking, you had a great, worked with a great graphic designer, because I just remember, I love the whole.
Yeah, that's 2x4, yeah.
Oh, that's the name of the company?
Yeah, 2x4.
Who's 2x4? I've heard of them.
2x4 is run by these three people, Michael Rock, Susan Sellers, and Georgie Stout, and they're sort of one of the, in addition to being like old and dear friends of mine,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they do all kinds of media, and I mean the most graphic design.
2x4, definitely know that. Definitely,
yeah, everything they've done a lot of work with Kanye, and they've done a lot of work with. They do all like the interior of like the Prada stores, and they're sort of very high end graphic design stuff,
right?
And because I'm an old friend, I sort of get, they do my graphic stuff.
Oh, that's really nice.
Yeah, so they're much too high end for me. They're much too high quality for me.
So they did a nice job. So this was before, of course, well before the earthquake, correct?
Yes.
By a year or two.
What happened is I started to make, I went down, I first of all, I made
it's a, been a while since I've seen, so forgive me.
Well,
if I'm forgetting.
So how we ended up in that film is that I'd made some friends of mine, this woman who I'd grown up with since I was a kid, had moved to Haiti, you know, 20, 30 years ago, and become a journalist and an activist, and like just a wild, incredible person who mm-hmm. did all kinds of, she ran like the opposition newspaper. She ended up becoming like a filmmaker and AP stringer down there, and traveling during the rise and fall of Aristide.
Right.
Spent a lot of time with this Haitian photographer called Daniel Morel. And her name is Jane Regan, and they traveled with the Cannibal Army during the overthrow of Aristide, and they just shot all this footage, and they had all these contacts. And they came to me, I guess this must have been like, I want to say 2005, 2006, and said, oh, we have all this footage and all these contacts, would you be interested in doing some projects together? And they had this amazing footage from all these things. And so we conceived a few films. One was about democracy, one was about betrayal, all these things. And the first one that we did was on democracy that we did for Wide Angle. And it was basically, how can rebels become Republicans, you know? Mm-hmm. And in that film, I came out of it feeling like I'd done what every other filmmaker had ever done in a place like Haiti or places. I'd tried to sort of understand the country by deconstructing a crisis du jour, mm-hmm. and trying to sort of understand it by examining a specific moment in time, and also examining it by deconstructing its problems. And while I was down there, Jane and Daniel had taken me up to northern Haiti, to Cape Haitien, and they had introduced me to this band that was a big band, 25 pieces, and they had been around for 60 years. And in Haiti, the average lifespan is 49 years. Like, nothing lasts more than a few years. There's such everything, you know, lives, institutions, governments. And this group of musicians was really interesting in that they were sort of dedicated to perpetuating the institution of the band beyond their own participation. And I kind of had this, like, pang. I said, well, you know, I've sort of done, I need to do something in penitence for the last film I made. And perhaps I could understand more about Haiti doing a film about something that works in Haiti than doing about what doesn't work. And I could do it. And I had this whole ridiculous idea of, you know, telling the story of Haiti through the music, and kind of like a Buena Vista social club, but with content.
Mm-hmm.
And I made the film. I shot the film and I made the film. I locked the film in like December of 2009 or 10. Almost the earthquake, 9, and then like 3 weeks later, the earthquake happened,
mm-hmm.
and my entire film
yeah.
was now not operable. And you can't launch a film about Haiti that doesn't have the earthquake in it. And so I went back to ITVS, who was funding it, and we talked, and I reconceived the film, and I spent another 6-8 months shooting and started to recut, and I basically reconceived the film. It was sort of told through music and history about how you create a country over 400 years where 200,000 people can die in 10 minutes. And realizing that, you know, prior to the earthquake, Columbus was an earthquake. And prior to the earthquake, slavery was an earthquake. And prior to the colonialism was an earthquake. And the revolution was an earthquake. And the self-rule was an earthquake. And the rise of Duvalier was an earthquake. And it was this series of earthquakes that led to this ultimate earthquake that took place. So that was sort of the idea of that film. Yeah, I think I finished it in 2012. So, but that took about 3 years to make. So, that was sort of the reason why I made that film was sort of, and I had this other idea to make a film based on Julius Caesar set in Aristide with this gang and in Gonaïves, but I kind of left that last film very, very confused as a filmmaker as to what I was trying to accomplish and thinking to myself, you know, who the fuck am I to be making films about Haiti? Mm-hmm. This is a middle-class white dude from Cambridge who, as you say, looks like a guy, middle-class white dude from Cambridge, a little Ivy League, a little filmmaking and sailing in his life. Mm-hmm. And I sort of came back and wanted to make films about the U.S. again. And that's in some ways where the Whiteness Project came from, was my sort of interest to think how do I, you know, to really make something about me and my community and do something that directly addresses me and my community.
Is a way, privilege.
Privilege is a way to sort of tackle something that I care about in a different way than just sort of being another middle-class filmmaker making films about poor brown people.
Right. I also feel like I'm attracted to when I see what I think is anybody's persona or package, you know, there's a lot there. And I know it, and it's going to be really interesting. And it's part of my what I was compelled to kind of sit with you too, because I feel like there's this guy. He's doing these really amazing projects, really fascinating projects. He's not on the surface in terms of what I'm exposed to in my film world as a prolific filmmaker, but I'm very interested in. I'm not saying you're not extremely busy all the time, but you know, I'm saying as far as output of your own features, you're not prolific, but you have a body of work. So I was kind of like interested in finding out what was going on behind all these particular choices of projects that you work on.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that
there's contrasts, you know, that are.
But I think in some ways, if you look at it, there's you know, there is certain themes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That run through all the work. And it's really, you know, in some ways, I mean, what we're all like, you know, all film. I also say
all
filmmakers, we're narcissistic public servants is kind of what I say.
that a thing?
you know, I don't know. I think that, yeah, I mean, I think that coming back, and I think that also one of the reasons why I haven't made more films, and I think I haven't made a feature length film. I mean, I produced Among the Believers, which was out last year as an executive producer, but I haven't directed a feature film since that, because I really started feeling trying to understand better the idea of authorship and storytelling in this world we're in, and I started to feel that what I was doing in sort of like forcing these big epic narrative stories and documentary was really kind of self-defeating in that it didn't really allow me to reach the kind of people that I wanted to reach them in the ways that I wanted to reach them. And the Whiteness Project has been this incredible sort of learning experience for me, because doing something that's been iterative, doing something that's been digital, doing something that has so many more millions of viewers than I've had. If you combined all my films, and I have more viewers, more reaction. It's been, it gets, the URLs that come in over the transom are from every country in the world. The direct contact I have with the people that I do with it. And I don't know how much you know about the project.
Not enough. So it's all, it's online, obviously.
Yeah. But it's online, and essentially it started as me being asked a question at a, giving a talk, and a seventh grade girl asked me about what my own racial identity, and sort of realizing that I had never really, even though I was interested in race and social justice and racial equity, I'd never really come to terms with the fact that my own race was sort of this active dynamic component that was impacting every moment of my everyday.
Right.
And I really wanted to create something that would give, and having that experience fundamentally transformed my relationship to the world, to my family, to everybody I meet, all my interactions, and really made me understand myself and the world in such a profound way that I wanted to create something that would give other people that experience. And ultimately, POV came in with some funds and allowed me to shoot the initial test piece, which I shot in Buffalo in 2014. And I thought, oh, it's going to be, I'll put it up and this will help me raise money to do it. Because I, you know, they had no money to just be able to spend on it. And the thing like erupted in a way that I've seen within, you know, I think within, I did probably 4 or 5 press things every day for 3 months after that. I was within 2 days, I was on CBS This Morning and NPR and, Take Part in all these different network shows. I started having a repeating thing with Melissa Harris Perry, and all this thing came out of this like tiny little idea of just asking white people what it meant to be white and putting it in a format that allowed people to watch it online in a way that was totally self-directed. So I started thinking differently about narrative, started thinking differently about storytelling, differently about how storytelling works in the media universe. And then I did the next installment of it last year and did an installation version of it at Tribeca. And I really feel I started stepping away from, okay, I'm going to go make this thing that's going to do a theater, and really think, well, I want to make something that can have multiple iterations. And that, then I did a project with it with Snapchat, where I worked with Snapchat and Vox, and I gave them all my material, and we created like a 24-hour story that like, you know, hit 800,000 kids between 14 and 18 in 24 hours. Like, reaching people with content in a way that this very, very constrained narrative of 90-minute narrative is never going to do. And what's happened with the project now is that it's now become a project, a research project, that it's now based, it's now housed at Columbia University's Interdisciplinary Center with Innovative Theory and Empirics, which I think is a fancy way to get to Insight as an acronym. But I'm working with this sociologist, Peter Behrman, who's one of those sort of the preeminent numbers crunchers, and we're collecting data on 10,000 people, and I'll be interviewing 1,000 people over the next 3 years to build this database on how whiteness is lived and constructed in communities all over the country. And it'll be the first study on whiteness by a major research institution built around this project that I launched. So when you, you know, you talked about like what sort of the arc of being a creator, like when I think about it, like I you know, I don't know if I'll ever make another film. I did a project last year with Corporate Public Broadcasting where I cast 4 filmmakers for a project on the military-civilian divide called Veterans Coming Home, and we did visited 14 states, and there were like 2 combat veterans and like Occupy Wall Street filmmaker and another really liberal filmmaker trying to make films about the military-civilian divide.
Yeah,
like, and I created a narrative arc structure for it, just like you would when you make a movie. But then we made 100 pieces of content that all fit into that matrix that then go out over different platforms and hopefully tell some story in the media thing. So I think I've really changed my thought process around what it means to be a storyteller.
Sure, it makes sense. I mean, you grew up in this type of existing structure, however you want to describe it, and that's what you know or knew. And so to be able at this point also in your career and in your life to kind of reinvent yourself is that's a pretty impressive thing. I mean, it might be a little too scary for some people, I don't know, to say that you may never make a film and be excited by that idea. Like saying, well, you found something that's more, sounds like that you're finding that's just the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, so, I mean, I like the idea of, you know, I'm really interested in how media works,
right,
and how do you actually meet audiences in different places. Now, that's not to say I'm in the process of a call tomorrow. I'm developing a documentary series with a production company in LA, mm-hmm, that may turn into like a bunch of linear narrative films. Mm-hmm. So the other thing is, like, you know, when we talk about like being sustainable, I try and be really open to engaging any potential iteration. I mean, I'm one of the things about documentary filmmakers, which you well know, is that we're all really curious, mm-hmm, right? We're all like, basically, you know, we're like those of us who are still around. We're the cat that, you know, that didn't get killed by the curiosity, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. That we're, and so I'm interested in, you know, I'm interested in all kinds of media and storytelling.
I understand.
And
it's getting to the message.
And I feel more and more I felt constrained by the structures of our community and,
yeah,
the conventions of our community.
Makes sense.
That
may not apply for some things and may apply for others.
Right.
You know.
So,
or
yes,
both may apply for something.
And that's why I think, yeah, you know, I was interested in Kickstarter. Yeah. Kickstarter was like, oh, this new paradigm. I can go to my
new
audience
paradigm
first.
Yeah.
I can do this.
Right.
As opposed to like going hat in hand to the same funders.
Right.
And like begging them for money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's a wonderful, I guess, thing I didn't anticipate that was going to come up. This is great. Mm. You know. So that's an ongoing, sounds like a big ongoing thing right now.
Yes, that's
so. But there is a certain amount of content available. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
or a certain amount.
Yeah, people just go to whitenessproject.com.
Whitenessproject.
Whitenessproject.org. They can see both the Buffalo and the Dallas interview sets, and they're basically just short interviews, mm-hmm, with data. Mm-hmm. I have a team in the new model of it. I basically just went out, shot the interviews, and then I worked with POV to develop all the data.
Mm-hmm.
And now I've sort of inverted the model where I have a team from Columbia, a sociology team, and they've developed these surveys, and we're just finished collecting data on I think 500 people in Michigan. And now over the next couple of weeks, I'll go through all those people and I'll pick 50 representational people to interview, and I'll do oral histories with them over the next month or so.
Yeah.
And then we'll replicate. Then we're going to take that, and we're doing an engagement piece with Facing History and Ourselves, Auburn Seminary, and Kindling Group is going to be running the sort of the on-the-ground engagement. And there'll be a whole set of engagement programs around it, and then we'll hopefully be – the idea is we're replicating that in 20 cities.
Mm-hmm.
So
– All American?
All American.
Okay. Well,
I mean, it's funny, man. I've gotten calls to – I've gotten – nothing has panned out yet, mm-hmm, but I've been approached by people in Finland, South Africa, and Canada.
Just because they just came upon your,
yeah,
the project.
Yeah, the project got, yeah, they said it got a lot of.
But Finland, do they have anything about white people there? Or just white and whiter?
Just white and whiter. Just whiter, yeah. I mean, it's.
I know South Africa may have people of different races, I mean, there. And certainly Europe and,
well, you could do it in Korea.
Anywhere there is
Korea,
colonialism.
I mean, it's not new. Whiteness isn't about,
right,
whiteness. Whiteness,
no,
is about monolithic ethnicity and power.
Right.
So you could do it in almost any place.
I see what you're, right.
You could do it in India around caste.
Sure.
You could do it, you know, there's, yeah, a lot of different ways. It happens that we have a very particular, like, you know, racial,
yeah,
structure here that's,
right,
built on white supremacy. That,
mm-hmm,
it's, you know,
yeah,
it was founded on white supremacy. And the legacy of white supremacy permeates.
We like to call
everything.
It manifest destiny.
Or American exceptionalism.
Well, and that's how we find ourselves exactly where we are right now,
yes,
in this country. So, okay, so go to whitenessproject.org.
Yes.
For this, for finding out more about this and seeing what's been done already. And then also you can Discover. As we said, POV will be broadcasting in mid-August, August 17th, you said? Or what day? I'll take care of all
date.
That. Okay. But anyway, it's I'll mention it in the introduction and promote it accordingly, too. And then that's for the Two Towns of Jasper. If you haven't seen it, it's an exceptional documentary co-directed by Whitney and Marco Williams, and then finally also your other feature when the drum is beating.
That's on Amazon or Netflix or something.
Okay.
And I think, I mean, it's actually interesting because the Whiteness Project is directly grafted off of Two Towns of Jasper.
Right.
I mean, it's I have a white film crew that interviews white people about being white.
Right.
And so it's part of my whole theory about, you know, about multi-strand storytelling and this idea we talk about post-truth world. And essentially, from the very get-go of my career, recognizing that I was living in a post-truth world. And the only way to understand a post-truth world or a alternative fact world or a multi-narrative world is to include multiple strands of narrative that surround the idea that you're trying to get at, because ultimately this idea that you're getting at some like truth is just, you know, laughable. Mm-hmm. And all you want to do is give people some sort of like an understanding of, I guess, you know, the understanding of the landscape is probably the best you can do.
Well said. Well said. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, truth is not, everybody's lost faith or trust in most of our institutions who are purportedly giving us truth, whether it's media, which I still have some belief in, but, you know, at least some percentage of it. Our lawmakers, our law enforcers, a lot of that's been lost in the last bunch of years. I think turning the camera towards ourselves, you know, let's just hear what people think and what people believe, because, you know, and we'll in a way, I think it's an opportunity in those instances to recapture some truth, because, you know, we're not trying to be elected or what have you. You know, we're just talking from the gut. You know what I'm saying? Whether it's polls that came out about a year ago saying who the president was going to be, 90% odds are, and then, you know, it's just complete fiction.
Well, I don't know if it's fiction. I just think it's that, you know, we came from this idea. I think the idea of post-truth world is that I think that up until, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there was sort of a media industrial complex who codified conventional wisdom. And there'd always been separate narratives. And now we actually just have these outlets that are really interpreting information differently. So, you know, I don't think that, I mean, there's certain insane outfits, but if you like look at the people at Breitbart, they're not thinking we're like advancing alternative facts. They believe in the truth of what they're doing. They believe in the truth of the narrative. They believe in the truth of their narrative. And they also, interestingly, it's also believe in the truth of what they believe is important. Meaning that if you look at like the leading headlines on all the different news sites, whether it's Politico or Breitbart or Fox or CNN, I sort of cycle through a lot of it. What is the framing of the day's
headline
news?
Are
all fundamentally different.
Right.
And that doesn't mean, then they're all, you know,
right.
Deciding what the lead is part of the ethos of determining what truth is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, anybody who's ever been in a relationship knows that there's like alternative facts and multiple narratives, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that somehow...
And getting back to Rashomon.
Yeah.
And also to working in advertising, by the way.
Yeah.
So you have... This is a running theme that runs through all your parts of your career. Truth. And, you know, how it's...
Yeah, and how it's malleable.
Conveyed and malleable. Malleable it is, yeah.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
I didn't have a big enough protein today to have such a deep conversation. I don't know if I'm holding up my end properly enough, but I think this is a good place to
pause. Good.
Yeah, I mean, It's a great conversation. I'm so glad that things are coming up, and we'll talk more in the future about maybe a 20th anniversary of this horrific crime that took place, or horrific event that took place in Jasper, you know, as a means of doing a screening. But no, I think the more people that see that film too, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, so well, good. It was great. I appreciate having me on, and
thank you.
Love the podcast and seeing what I'll see. Interesting. What makes it? How long is the podcast usually? 20 minutes?
No, it just sort of depends. It's not untypical for me to do like an hour long episode with just one person as well. I prefer that. In fact, mm-hmm. I think a lot of listeners do too. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.